She frowned, her small dark face intent on her thoughts. Weena likes him well enough. I mean, you could tell. She laughed at his jokes, and they talked all the time, but... Ali, she doesn't trust him. I don't think she even knows how little she trusts him. She never let them escape their bodyguards on our rides.
Interesting, Ali said thoughtfully, sharpening her magical sight so that she could keep an eye on Sarai and her escorts still galloping down the road.
She doesn't think he'd dishonor Sarai, does she?
I don't know, Dove replied.
What I know is that Weena understands the prince as well as anybody, even better than Papa. Her not trusting him to behave honorably? That worries me. Doesn't it worry you? Because I don't think we've seen the last of His Highness, not at all.
Ali looked at the 12-year-old.
You're very observant, she remarked.
And cold, Dove said, her mouth pulled down in distaste. You didn't say cold. Everyone does.
But you're not cold, Ali replied. You've learned to hide yourself, to hide in plain sight.
Like you, Dove pointed out. Ali grinned. You have to admit it's very useful. Dove chuckled. When she did, her face lit with a powerful light.
Do you play chess?
A little, replied Ali, who could almost beat her grandfather, one of the finest players in Tortal.
Good, Dove said cheerfully. It's getting harder to lose, so Papa doesn't realize what I'm doing. I can tell him I'm teaching you.
After their return to the castle, Ali laid out clean clothes for Dove, then went in search of their new mage. She found Ochabu in the room set aside for the healer and any patients at the back of the kitchen wing. The old woman was hanging up bunches of dry herbs next to those Rihanni had already prepared. Shelves along one side of the infirmary, once empty but for Rihanni's collection of salves, liquids, and tools, now bore a collection of medical and magical tools, substances, and books.
"What do you want?"
Ochobu demanded, stretching to hang a bunch of dried mint from a beam overhead. Ali leaned against the doorframe and smiled.
"I wanted to see how you were settling in."
"I confess, I thought you'd prefer to live in a hut behind the stable than here within Luaran walls." Ochobu glared at her.
"If I say I will do a thing, I do it," she informed Ali stiffly. "I have come to safeguard the Lady Sarai and to help you win your wager. If the Balitong children survive the summer, there will be one less Luaran in the Isles, at least, and you are a particularly annoying one."
Ali raised her brows.
"So the god told you of our bet? Does Ulasim know?"
Ochabu shook her head.
"The god spoke to me in the night. He says you are only a temporary irritation. He thinks that with the summer over, the Luaran rulers will have sorted out the kingship. The lady who may or may not be our promised one shall be safe for the winter."
She poured juniper berries from a bowl into a mortar and began to mash them, releasing their piney scent. The mention of the end of the wager itched Ali. Being called a temporary irritation was also quite annoying.
"There are too many of us to kill, you know,"
she pointed out, thinking she was starting to talk like her father. "Too many who have been here 3 centuries.
"Do you think I don't know that?"
demanded Ochabu, pausing in her work to scowl at Ali.
"I'll have to get used to Luaran, even if they aren't you."
"You will if you don't want a massacre," Ali said, holding the old woman's eyes with hers. "If you don't want to mark your return to power with killing. How much Luaran blood will you discard? Half-bloods? You'd murder your own lady, then. She'd object to the murder of her Luaran father and stepmother, in any case. Quarter-bloods? Eighth-bloods? How much do you count as being too much?"
"Stop it," growled the old woman. "The Raka people are not like the first 3 Ritavan kings, slaughtering those who would not bend the knee to them. We are not murderers."
"That's not what I learned at my dad's knee," Ali retorted.
Her mental image of people executed by righteous natives was too awful for her to let Ochopu's prejudices stand without argument.
"The Raka used to kill all the time. Your nobles and your rather temporary queens in the years before the Luaran came were so busy battling each other that you didn't have the strength to fight off an invasion. By the time you banded together, it was too late."
"I know that," Ochabu growled, mashing her berries with ferocity. "All of us who inherited this mess know."
"Is a mess what you mean to give your new queen?" Ali wanted to know. "How can she be sure her people will stand behind her? Or will you put a dagger in her back for the crime of not choosing a father the Raka will approve?"
Ollie inspected her fingernails. They would need work if she was to continue as a maid rather than a goat herd.
Personally, I think you might do well with Sarai on the throne.
Silence!
Ochebu interrupted, glaring at Ollie.
No names!
Ollie raised an eyebrow at her and waited. Ochebu laid her pestle aside.
We have lived too long as tenants on lands that our foremothers owned. I know that. I know what is at stake. I can see for myself that a certain young woman is royal in two bloodlines, and that seems to fit the prophecy. But I am no lapdog, trained to roll onto my back for you or any other Luaran. I am here to make up my own mind.
Ollie brushed a speck from her sleeve. Then let me tell you something I've observed. Those you call Luaran here, including the ones who are part Luaran, part Ra'ka, they aren't citizens of the eastern or southern lands. They see themselves as Kyprians. They took your land's names for their own. They've made the Isles prosper. I think they've earned the right to stay if they don't side with the Ritavans when the time comes.
Is that the god speaking through you?
Ochebu demanded, her eyes flinty.
Or just you?
Ollie fought the urge to give Nawat's wing shrug for a reply. I assume the god picked me for my opinions as well as my skills, however temporary I might be. I am an outsider. Sometimes we see more clearly than those who live inside the problem.
I'll be better off when you leave, Ochebu complained.
For the moment she sagged, the lines of her face deepening.
You have given me a headache. Go away.
Ollie went. She took lunch with the Balitang women and spent the afternoon with Sarai and Dove as they played with Elsrin and Patran. After Winamine summoned the two older girls to their newly begun weapons training, Ollie occupied herself with household mending and a quick search of Sergeant Farron's rooms to read his latest reports to the Crown. Once she had finished, she asked Chenaul to heat water for the sisters' baths, then laid out the girls' supper dresses. Bored with nothing to do but mend clothes, Ollie wandered over to the window to look out over the inner courtyard. Below her, Dove and the men-at-arms practiced archery. Ollie leaned her elbows on the sill to watch and nearly yelped before she caught herself. Someone had come up with a new game. Nawat stood against the wall, relaxed and alert. Before him, two men-at-arms were preparing to shoot. Dove stood behind one archer with a handful of arrows, while the Duchess held arrows for the second archer. Ollie's mind told her that the Duchess would hardly consent to murder just as the first man shot. The second man shot immediately after him. Then both set fresh arrows to the string and shot steadily, arrow after arrow, one at a time, until they had exhausted all the extras held by the Duchess and her stepdaughter. Nawat caught them all with grace and ease, snatching the arrows from the air as if he had all day to do so. When the archers finished, he gathered the heap of arrows at his feet and carried them back to their owners.
He's so fast, Ollie thought in awe.
I couldn't do it, and I'm no slouch. She sighed, wishing Da were here to see it. He'd taught her to catch daggers in midair, but this game was much more hazardous. The game was not done. The men-at-arms repeated the experiment with javelins, then hunting and combat spears. Nawat caught them all, moving so fast Ollie couldn't follow his hands. She cheered him and the men-at-arms on. When the bell rang to remind the household it was nearly time for supper, he looked up at the applauding Ollie and waved.
"This is my favorite game," he called to her. "Do you want to play?"
"I wouldn't dare," she cried, laughing, before she retreated into the room. She'd seen men catch knives before. She'd seen the finest archers in the Queen's Riders draw an outline in arrows of someone positioned against a wooden fence or wall just to show they could do it. She had never seen anything like this. Sarai and Dove ran in. Sarai smiled at Ollie.
"You should have seen your face. Did you know he could do that?"
she asked as she collapsed on her bed. Dove unstrung her bow, shaking her head.
"He's amazing," she said, coiling her bowstring. "You know, maybe this horrible old place isn't so bad,"
Sarai told the ceiling.
"Not if these wonderful men keep showing up."
Ollie raised an eyebrow at her. "I wouldn't try kissing him," she warned. "It wouldn't be what you expect." Sarai wrinkled her nose.
"Ollie," she complained, "I've found out he eats bugs. I'm not kissing a man with bug breath."
Ollie blinked.
I don't remember him tasting of bugs when he kissed me, she thought. I'd better pay more attention next time. Her mind promptly reined her up. This was highly improper. There would be no next time. Her task was looking after the Balitang children, not mooning over someone, particularly not a crow-turned man, even if he could pluck arrows from the air. The next morning, Ali, still on a goatherd's hours, walked out of the keep into the dawn. The sun had just cleared the walls to light the inner courtyard and the young man who straddled a bench there. Ali stopped to watch him carefully glue pieces of feather onto the wooden shaft. Nawat looked up at her with a smile that lit his eyes. "You are beautiful in the new light," he told her. "If I were the dawn crow, I would bring you the sun to hatch as our first nestling." Ali blinked at him. Her heart felt strangely squeezed by some powerful emotion. She bit her lip to distract herself from a feeling that made her horribly unsure. "Have you been kissing anybody?" she asked without meaning to, and gasped. She had let words out of her mouth without thinking, which was not like her. Worse, they were such personal words. Ones he might feel meant personal feelings she did not have. This was the kind of thing that other girls said, those girls who were not bored by all the young men who had courted them. How many handsome fellows had side compliments to Ali while, unconcerned, she had mentally wrestled with breaking a new code? At home, she never cared about her suitors enough to worry if they kissed other girls. She scrambled to blot out what she'd said. "Not that it's any of my business, but you should understand, people have a way of kissing for fun, without it meaning anything serious, and I'd hate for you to think someone wanted you to mate-feed them just because they're kissing." "Stop babbling," her mind ordered. Ali stopped. Nawat's smile broadened. That disturbing light in his eyes deepened. "I have kissed no one but you, Ali," he assured her, serious. "Why should I kiss anyone else?" Ali gulped. "You can continue this conversation, or you can talk about something less giddy," she told herself, "less frightening." "You know, I won't always be around," she said abruptly. "I don't belong here, really." "Then I will go with you," Nawat said. "I belong with you." "He doesn't know what he's saying," Ali told herself. "He doesn't know what that means." She looked at him, arms folded, trying to keep any extra feelings from leaping out. "What are you doing?" she asked, to change the subject to anything less dangerous. Then she grimaced. He was fletching arrows, as always. She glanced at his bench, then bent down. He was fletching, but these arrows were heavier, and the feathers he used were not bird feathers, but storm wing. "How did you cut them up?" she wanted to know, genuinely curious. More scraps of cut-up steel feathers lay on the bench. Nawat pointed to a long piece of what looked like black, chipped glass. "Shiny volcano rock," he told Ali. "Chip the edge until it's sharp. That cuts stormwing feathers. They come from the heat of the place where stormwings were born." Ali touched the glassy blade. "Obsidian," she said. "That's its name." "Yes," Nawat replied. "Shiny volcano rock." He set a length of steel feather into a thin groove filled with glue and held it in place. Ali didn't see a single cut on his hands, though the feathers were lethally sharp. "Won't they be too heavy for the glue?" she asked. "I shaped the glue. It holds stormwing feathers," Nawat answered. "Stormwings really are born in volcanoes?" Ali inquired, curious. "In the beginning time, when they were first dreamed," replied Nawat, setting another piece of steel feather in its slot. "Now, if carrying an egg does not kill the mother, they are born from steel eggs." He looked at Ali and sighed, his dark eyes wistful. "The eggs are too heavy for a crow to take." "You've already taken enough from stormwings," Ali told him, pointing to the small pile of glinting feathers beside his bench. "You could have been killed." "There is a trick to it," he replied, and blew lightly on his fletchings. Holding the arrow shaft before one eye, he squinted down its length. "Perfect," he declared, and set the arrow down. "It seems like a lot of trouble and risk when goose feathers are safer to work with," Ali remarked. "What is a stormwing fletched arrow for, anyway?" "They are mage killers," replied Nawat. "No matter if the mage is powerful, if he has great spells to protect him, a stormwing arrow will cut through illusion and magic."
Ali whistled softly, impressed.
Take very good care of those, then, she told Nawat. We might find a use for them.
I made them for you, Nawat said, giving her that radiant, innocent smile.
They are yours, for a day when they will help you.
He offered a finished arrow shaft to her.
Ali smiled at him despite the goosebumps that rippled along her skin.
Keep them until they're needed, please, she told him. My archery skills aren't very good.
You could practice, Nawat pointed out.
I'm a slave, Ali explained. Slaves who are caught with weapons are killed.
Then do not be a slave, he said matter-of-factly.
Fly free.
Not just yet, she replied. I'll see the summer out first.
5 days later, a well-guarded messenger arrived on the plateau. Crows and Raka patrols encircled and held the small group until Veron and the castle guard arrived. As the Balitang men-at-arms approached, the Raka guards scattered to make Veron think they were robbers, and not fighters who had been assigned to keep new arrivals away from the Balitangs until they were searched. Ali and her riding companions, out on the road west of Tener, heard the crows' alarm. They arrived at the eastern road at the same time as Veron. Ali murmured a suggestion to Fezgao that he join in the search. If the new arrivals were royal assassins, Ali suspected Veron would take them to the Balitangs. With Fezgao involved, she knew no killers sent by the crown would go undiscovered. She watched as the men-at-arms questioned the strangers, looking for anything unusual. None of them lied in answer. As it turned out, their errand was a normal one. They bore thank-you gifts from Bronau, purchased in Damari before he sailed. They also brought letters from those friends who had been writing to the exiles all along, as well as letters from those who had decided it was safe to correspond now that Hazarin might recall them to the capital. After supper, Winamine, Sarai, and Dove played soldiers on the floor with Elsrin and Patran. Pemberi, Ali, and Rahani worked on sewing as the Duke opened the letters and read them aloud to the family. Ali saw that Winamine, normally so controlled, could not keep a tiny, sarcastic smile from her lips as people who had been silent for weeks now proclaimed their affection for the Balitangs. Sarai's toy soldiers acted fiercely as she struggled to control her anger with such fair-weather friends. The Duke shook his head sadly as he read. Dove practiced that staple item of a young noblewoman's studies, a facial expression of polite interest that gave away none of her true feelings. Ali silently applauded Dove's skill. The 12-year-old was much better at that polite control than Sarai. For herself, Ali could only give a mental shrug as she stitched. It was human nature for people to protect themselves from a monarch's temper. That went triple for everyone who lived under the king's eye in Rajmuat. There was news, too, from the eastern and southern lands. Ali barely listened to the word from Karthak. Emperor Kadar and his empress were still dealing with that realm's far-flung malcontents, though Kadar's grip on his throne grew firmer with each passing year. She was far more interested in news from the eastern lands, though she pretended the same indifference as she had for Karthak. The Scanran War continued, but the end was in sight. There were rumors that unhappy clansmen had secretly reached out to the Tortalan monarchs, offering peace and trade for their king's head. Ali hoped that their majesties, ably assisted by people like her mother, would choose to hammer the Scanrans for a while longer. It would ensure that fresh Scanran attacks would not take place for at least another generation. After the Duke had read all the letters he wanted to share, he opened the trunk from Bronau. Once again there were new books for him, the Duchess, and Dove. There was a wooden pull-along knight on horseback for Elsrin, who abandoned his soldiers, and a new doll for Patran, who immediately did the same. For Sarai there was a gold necklace, its fine chain decorated with citrine drops along its length, and a matching bracelet. The older girl put them on immediately and went to the Duchess's looking-glass to admire them.
"He remembered how much I like citrines," she told them all.
"Huzzah for him," muttered Dove. Ali, the only one who heard, grinned. Mequen shifted uneasily in his chair. Winamine reached over and rested a hand on his arm.
"So my old friend courts you, Sarai," the Duke said, watching her with concern in his eyes. "Of course, his friends have suggested that he marry for years, but we thought—"
"Oh, Papa, it's not serious. He's just flirting," Sarai replied.
"That's very different from what you've said before," the Duchess pointed out.
Well, I'm 16 and giddy, Sarai told them mischievously. My husband had best be faithful to me alone. Bronow isn't likely to do that. Besides, unless King Hazarin gifts him with offices or estates, he's not very wealthy. She went to kneel beside her father. Don't fret, Papa, she said, her face turned up to his. I'd never do anything without your approval. She looked at Winamine, hesitated, then said, Or yours, Wina. Ali looked down, not wanting anyone to realize she had seen the sudden happiness in the Duchess's face. It made her feel very much an outsider. She missed her mother, prickly though she was. The July days that followed were filled with hazy summer heat that made even the lightest cotton stick to their skins. Despite the temperatures, Ali did not give in to the urge to laze. She sewed, cleaned, and helped Sarai and Dove to amuse the younger children so that Rehani could help to put up herbal teas and medicines against the winter. At night, Ali met with the Raqqa conspirators, Ochabu and Nawat, going over what news had come in that day from Crows, People, and Ochabu's scrying bowl. They discussed fresh arrivals in the valley, while the Raqqa filled Ali in on who in the Isles might support them in times of trouble, the nature of those times left carefully undescribed, as well as who it was who might turn on them. Each day, Sarai bounced away from the breakfast table, Ali and Dove following at a sleepy distance. Outside, they would find their mounts and guards waiting by the stables. Some days they had instructions, errands to run for the Duchess or mushrooms, berries, and herbs to collect for Chenaol and Ochabu. Other days, Nawat came with them, to collect wood for arrows or simply to keep the girls amused. Fulton is an easy master indeed, Sarai remarked on Nawat's third such ride with them. She looked at him sidelong through her lashes and made her mare prance so that Nawat might look at her hips if he chose. Ali just shook her head, remembering that she had flirted just as much when she wasn't working for her father and grandfather. She wished that Sarai had something serious to do with her time instead of wasting it in the enticement of a man who didn't see her as a potential mate. Not, she told herself hurriedly, that she cared if Nawat did look at Sarai as a potential mate. Fulton the Boyer tells me I'm only young once, and the winters indoors are long, Nawat replied, his eyes not on Sarai's hips, but on Ali's face. Their group often carried medicines brewed by Ochabu and Rehani to the villages of Inti and Pohan. If they were not invited to take their lunch with the wealthier families, they found shady brookside places to eat their bread, cheese, and whatever else Chenaol might have packed for them. Afterward, they would doze, cool their feet in the water, talk, or sew. If it wasn't too hot, they practiced hand-to-hand combat and weapon skills with Ali and Junai. Ali loved the long, slow days filled with the buzz of crickets and the sight of blindingly white clouds scudding over the turquoise sky. Summer was as beautiful on Lomban as at Pirate Swoop. She barely missed the stacks of reports at home, the bustle of messengers coming and going, or her fair weather round of visits to relatives and foster relatives. As lazy as the time could be, Ali never forgot who her companions were. Everywhere they went, the Raqqa turned out to look at the Balitang girls. Sarai always stopped to say hello, to learn their names, admire their children, and listen to their old people. The girls would be offered cups of the villainous Kyprian tea, which they had to accept or risk offending their hosts. Drinking it, Ali always wondered if it could be used to remove varnish from furniture. She had hoped that the novelty of watching Sarai might wear off, but she reckoned without Sarai or the Raqqa. Like Ali's mother, Sarai detested going home by the same route she had taken to leave it. She led them along tracks Ali would have sworn were game trails, past small farms, hunters' cabins, and mining and lumber camps on the plateau's edge. They chatted with people Ali suspected were poachers and others she knew were smugglers. Sarai greeted women dyeing cloth and men tanning hides. Ali would not have suspected that so much of the plateau was taken up by farms or that Sarai had a talent for locating them all. Despite her reservations about the Raqqa mounting a successful rebellion, Ali had to admit that Sarai showed promise. She had the same air of genuine interest in people's lives that Queen Thayet had shown when Ali had accompanied her godmother on trips. Sarai cared for the people, and they responded. Looking at her, their faces were bright with hope.
Ali could only pray that their hopes were fulfilled for them and for Sarai. One day they rode to Inti. When they got within view of the village, Ali, who had been using her sight to eye the road ahead, made the girls halt. 30-odd people were camped on the village outskirts. As they stopped, a Ra'ka patrol melted out of the trees on the northern side of the road. Their leader rode out to meet Fezgao. The two men spoke briefly. Fezgao then brought his horse around and came back to their group.
"They are Ra'ka," he told the girls. "They have come to see the lady."
His long eyes flicked up to Sarai's face, then away. To Ali, he said,
"It is well. They came up from the coast and have no taint of the assassin to them."
"Then let's say hello," Sarai declared.
"It's the least we can do if they've made that horrible climb up the western road."
Ali still didn't like it, but she had no choice. Sarai had already urged her gelding forward. As they approached, the Ra'ka patrol vanished under the trees once more, while the Ra'ka in the camp gathered on either side of the road. Watching Sarai approach the nearest of them, Ali sent a hurried call to Kiprioth for help.
"Let them see their ladies," the god replied.
His voice boomed in the empty air, coming from the open sky. The Ra'ka from the camp immediately dropped to their knees. Sarai hurriedly controlled her mount and doves as the frightened horses began to plunge and fight the rain. The guards' mounts held steady, though white showed all the way around their eyes. Ali's cinnamon calmly helped herself to mouthfuls of grass.
"Let them greet Sarayu and Dovaseri," Kiprioth went on, "and return to speak of them in their home villages with hope."
As Sarai dismounted, Ali directed an angry but unspoken remark to the god.
"It was a private question. Why did you have to make such a revelation of it?"
"Because this is part of the biggest trick I have ever played," the god said for her ears alone. "Because they must be heralded with signs of divine favor. I just showed them some."
"You upset the horses," Ali retorted silently.
"Show off."
"Now you begin to understand me."
The god's private voice was filled with amusement.
"I knew it would happen sooner or later."
Sarai passed her reins to Ali. She started forward, then turned to glare at Dove. Ali nudged Cinnamon closer to the younger girl.
"I'll hold your mare," she offered.
"What are we getting ourselves into?" Dove whispered.
"If word of things like this gets back to the palace, we'll be cooked in front of its gates over a slow fire."
Despite her concern, she dismounted and gave her horse's reins to Ali. Fezgao and the rest of the guards were getting down from their mounts, too. Ali sighed and did the same for them. She knew better than to even ask Junai to hold the horse's reins. Junai would say, quite properly, that as a guard in an uncertain situation, she had to keep her hands and her attention free. The Ra'ka bowed low to the girls, arms crossed over their chests, palms to their shoulders. These were poor people, Ali noted, with scarcely an unpatched jacket or sarong to their names. Their numbers encompassed all ages and both sexes, from people so old they were carried in stretchers to babies still at the breast. Ali observed the crowd as the guards watched those closest to the Balitong girls, alert for assassins who might have slipped by the patrol. All went quietly. Once each Ra'ka had said hello and told Sarai a little about him or herself, they bowed, collected their belongings, and quietly left their camp.
"They appeared overnight from the coast,"
said Inti's headman when they finally reached the village itself.
"They haven't been any trouble, but they said they meant to stay until they saw you. I don't see what I could have done."
"Next time, send word," snapped Fezgao, his normal calm disturbed by the unexpected encounter. "We could have brought more guards with us."
On their way home, Ali dropped behind to ride next to Fezgao. Softly she asked, "Is there any way to keep such groups from coming? It attracts attention." The man shook his head.
"The Ra'ka have lived without hope for so long," he explained. "I cannot blame them for wanting to see it with their own eyes."
"If you think these girls will let you foment a rebellion in their names, you will get a rude awakening," Ali cautioned Fezgao.
"They and their parents are loyal to the crown."
"Ah, but is the crown loyal to them?" asked the Ra'ka. "That has yet to be seen."
Fort Mastiff, Tortal,
on the Scanran border. This was yet another of her dream visits to Tortal, Ali realized, coming from sleep to wakefulness in the air above a large, new wooden fortress. It flew the flag of the realm of Tortal, a silver sword and a silver crown on a blue shield. Beneath it flew a scarlet flag with a golden cat rearing on it, the banner of the king's champion, Alana the Lioness. Ali could see her famous mother below, planted solidly at the center of a ring of onlookers. She was dueling with someone. From the fighters' quilted tunics and absent helmets, Ali judged that this was a practice session, not a real fight. Though both her mother and her opponent wielded live sword blades, there was a risk. Ali drifted down, curious about who might be mad enough to take on her mother, even for practice. By the looks of things, Alana was overmatched. Her opponent was nearly 6 feet tall, broad-shouldered, with muscled legs revealed by cotton breeches. Sweat-soaked brown hair, cut short at the nape of the neck and across the forehead, framed a face tanned in the sun and brown hazel eyes, a dreamer's eyes, with ridiculously long lashes. Those eyes were steady as they watched the lioness's sword.
"Go, Kel!" someone yelled from the sidelines. "Youth and skill!"
"Age and treachery!"
bellowed a large man on the far side of the ring. Ali knew him. Lord Raoul of Golden Lake and Mallory's Peak was one of her adoptive uncles, a big man who kept a short, brown-skinned woman in the circle of his arm, even as he urged his friend Alana on. Ali recognized the brown woman as yet another of her adoptive aunts, Bori, married to Uncle Raoul less than a year.
"Youth and skill!"
cried another man Ali knew well, Neelan of Queenscove, her mother's former squire.
"Don't let that old lady cut you, Kel!"
"Whose side are you on?" Alana demanded, her eyes flicking over to Neil. "You were my squire!"
Her opponent surged forward as the lioness's attention wavered, her blade slicing the air in an overhand swing. This had to be Kelladry of Mindelon, Ali realized, fascinated. Since Ali had been 8 or so, her mother had spoken continually of Kelladry, the first girl to go for her knighthood since Alana. For a while, Ali had been jealous of the girl, thinking her mother was more interested in Kel than she was in Ali. Only in the last few years had she realized her mother simply understood Kel better than she understood Ali. Kel bore in on her smaller foe fast, but Alana came up and under Kel's attack, smacking the bigger woman hard in the ribs.
"You've been using that pig sticker of yours so much you've forgotten how to wield your griffin," Alana taunted. "You've gotten lazy."
Griffin, Ali thought, then remembered. Mother said Kel had named the sword Alana had given her Griffin. Kel lunged in again, her sword blade tangling with the lioness's, until the two women were locked together, hilt to hilt. Now Kel brought her superior height and weight to bear, forcing the lioness down and back.
"Lazy, is it?" Kelladry said, panting. "I'll give you laziness, shorty."
Alana laughed and sprang free of the tangle, darting around to swat Kelladry on the behind with the flat of her blade.
"Age and treachery," she taunted Kel.
Kel stood back and, gasping, saluted Alana with her weapon.
"I guess I need to work on my sword skill after all, lioness," she said, accepting someone's water bottle.
She nodded toward the gate.
"I think we have company."
A tall, gray figure, Taka, the basilisk, strode through the gate, holding his long tail off the ground as a lady would hold the train to her gown. From crown to tail, he was covered in dust that turned his beaded gray skin to gray-brown.
"Taka," cried Alana, running to greet the newcomer. "Whatever brings you here?"
The basilisk bent his head so that he could whisper into her ear. Ali dropped down until she was close enough to hear him.
"I bear news from your husband."
Taka's voice was like the whisper of flutes.
"He asks me to tell you that he's got real word at last, from Rajmwat. You must not worry if he disappears for a time."
Alana seized the basilisk's paw. Ali, looking around, saw that everyone else was keeping a respectful distance from the unlikely pair.
"Ali," whispered Alana, "he's got word of her?"
Taka nodded. Alana turned and walked speedily back to her quarters, the men shifting out of her path. Like Ali, they knew the set look on Alana's face meant she didn't want to talk to anyone.
"Please tell me you have good news,"
Lord Raoul had walked over to greet the basilisk.
Whatever it is.
She's been as jumpy as a horse covered in ants all summer.
I sorrow to hear it, said the basilisk. I can tell you that diplomats from Skanra are in chorus to negotiate a peace treaty.
His information was greeted with a shout from the people who had followed Raoul to say hello to the newcomer. Ali's dream began to fade as men and boys ran to tell their fellows to cause news. Ali opened her eyes. She lay on her pallet in the great hall. Looking at the torch that still burned to light any late comings and goings on the main stair, she saw that it was the middle of the night, with a few more hours to go until dawn. A fresh torch set by the stairs always burned out just before sunrise. Someone nearby snored. Ali heard a dog's claw scratch on the stone flags as their owner dreamed of hunting. Farther off, she heard a rustle of mice. She stared into the dark.
Da was coming to Rajmuat, she realized. He would track her to the slave pens, then to the Balitong's townhouse, then to Lomben. It might take him weeks.
He could not use his Kiprish agents. He would have to question people without seeming to question them. He would be looking for a girl with hair, not one shaved bald, but sooner or later he would find Ali and want to take her home. She'd go, of course. She hoped he could wait till the equinox, so that her bet would be done with. And then she'd return to the safety of Pirate Swoop. If all went as it was supposed to, Da would then let her do field work.
And what happens to the Balitongs then, she asked herself. What happens to the Ra-Ka?
She wouldn't think of that.
Da needed her. Mother missed her. And there were her brothers, her grandparents, and her adoptive family. She could see them once the Balitongs were safe, if she didn't go home with Da right away. There was an idea. Back to sleep. The only result she would have from worrying about it now was daytime exhaustion from lack of a proper night's rest. Da would come when he came.
If you're to lie to a god, and sometimes it's very useful, do it with the truth. They smell lies on two-leggers, or they see it, or whatever it is they do. But if all you're telling them is whatever part of your lie that's truthful, they'll accept it. The gods don't see what's always in our minds. Mayhap they'd go mad if they knew everything we think as we think it. I know I would. Besides, mortals were granted the right to make our own choices when we were shaped. So if a god's got no reason to be suspicious, he won't enter your mind to find that you've only spoken half the story. Dane Sarasri, daughter of the Galan goddess the Green Lady, and the hunt god Weren, to her 15-year-old adopted niece, Ali, during a discussion of the Immortals' War. Chapter 14. Pivot. The first group of Outland Ra-Ka had been gone 3 days when another came in. They, too, would not leave until after they had seen Sarai. 5 days later, a third group arrived at Inti. This one was the largest yet, a regular caravan from the coast that masked its real purpose by carrying sealskins, whale oils, shell buttons, salt, beads, and dried seaweed to trade. To support their story of coming to Inti on business, Sarai sent a villager for her father and Ulasim, who could ride to Inti and do business for the family. She told her companions they would spend the night in the village, since she had so far met only half of the caravan's members. Their group took supper with the newcomers and introduced them to Mekwen and Ulasim when they arrived with their guards. In a gesture of goodwill, Inti's headman gave up his home to the Balitongs for the night. Inside at last, Ali set the pallet they'd found for her at the foot of the large bed shared by Sarai and Dove. Exhausted by watchfulness among a crowd of unknown Ra-Ka and by a secret but thorough search of their wagons and gear, Ali plunged into sleep as soon as her eyes closed. Kiprioth awaited her in the glowing form he'd used to show her King Oren's death. "What now?" Ali demanded crossly. "I have enough on my plate at the moment without you dragging me all over the mortal realms." "You will be glad to know this by the time we are done, my dear," the god informed her. "It is the pivot on which all else turns. I've yet to meet a spy who didn't want all the information he or she could stand." "You could at least pretend to be sorry you bothered me," Ali grumbled as the god passed a glowing arm firmly around her waist. and deprive you of whining?" he asked as they shot through the roof of the house into the open sky beyond. "I have noticed how careful you are not to complain to those you serve. I thought it only fair to let you berate me a little." "That wasn't berating you," Ali said darkly, even as she savored their passage over velvety land and watched the brilliant stars overhead. "When I berate you, you'll know it." She sighed dramatically.
"Not that you'll care."
"I won't," Kiprioth replied as they soared over the azure sea. Far below, a long, sinuous form arched up along the water, scattering it in diamond drops in the starlight. Kiprioth crooned a greeting to the whale, who called back as its tail popped free of the water, then passed into it again. "Though I know that I will prize the way you phrase yourself, I am certain that you will be more than eloquent at the art of berating." Ali replied with a rude invitation not commonly offered to a god, startling a peal of laughter from Kiprioth. "Whatever else I may say of you, and I'm sure there will be plenty, at least you have a sense of humor," she added.
"I am a trickster," he replied in a modest tone.
Gods, Ali thought. They always insist on having the last word. All too soon the journey was over. They settled into the king's bedroom in the palace at Rajmuat. The curtains over the terrace doors were drawn against the night air, cooler here above the harbor. The chamber was dark except for one small lamp by the door to the outer room and another by the door to what looked like the privy. Servants slept on pallets all around the room, ready to jump up to do the king's bidding if he needed anything in the night. On the bed, King Hazarin slept alone, pouting even in his dreams. He labored to breathe, releasing the occasional snore.
"He ate richly tonight," Kiprioth observed in a tone of mild interest. "Venison and wine sauce, pork with a pineapple and honey gravy, buffalo coconut curry, sticky coconut peanut rice with currants and almonds, 5 different wines from the eastern lands."
"He always eats like that?" Ali wanted to know, awed.
"The richer the better," replied Kiprioth. "He insists on at least 5 coconut dishes at every meal, though healers keep telling him a lighter diet would be better. It's really a toss-up as to what kills him first, his heart or an apoplexy of the brain. Actually, I have a bit of a wager on with my cousin the graveyard hag about that."
He went quiet. Hazarin bolted upright in bed, his eyes open and staring as he fought to breathe. His plump hands went to his head. He uttered a strangled noise loud enough to wake 2 of the sleepers around him. As they struggled to their feet, Hazarin fell back on his pillows, eyes wide. He stared blankly upward as his hands flopped down. He gaped endlessly as the anxious servants felt his throat and his wrists. The woman who held his wrist looked at the man who touched the big veins in Hazarin's throat. The man shook his head, then cocked his head to put his ear over Hazarin's open mouth. The woman turned to look at the other sleepers.
"Wake up, you fools!" she snapped, her voice low and cutting. "Something's happened to the king!"
Blankets flew as the sleepers roused in a panic. Within moments they had silently lit more lamps. One man thrust a blanket under the edge of the main door to keep the light from showing outside. Ali understood what was going on. These were the acts of people who might die if anything questionable took place in the room where the king slept. They all gathered around Hazarin, some making the star-shaped sign against evil when they saw the king's face.
"He's dead," the man who had listened for the king's breath told his fellows. "I don't know why, but he is."
"We must call a healer," said a young maid. As she turned toward the door, one of the men grabbed her arm.
"Idiot,"
he snapped, keeping his voice low.
"What if it's poison? Who will be blamed? He was fine when he rose from supper, fine when he came to bed."
"He mentioned a headache," interrupted the woman who'd been the first to wake.
"Not a headache bad enough to call the healer," retorted the man who had stopped the younger maid. "Now he's dead. If it's poison..."
"They'll say it was one of us," murmured someone else. "They always do." None of them said another word. Silently they collected their belongings and fled through a door to the servants' stair hidden behind a tapestry. The last to leave blew out the lamps.
"They'll have gone to ground in the city by dawn," Kiprioth remarked to Ali. "And they'll escape Rajmuat by noon if they have any sense. Stay here. I have a wager to collect from the graveyard hag. I told her it was folly to bet on a Ritavan king actually having a heart.
Wait,
Ali said. The god bent his glowing head down to listen.
Why don't you tell those poor people his death was natural, that they can't be blamed?
I could, if you want them to return and be tortured anyway. The new regent will want to make sure his death was accidental. Healers make mistakes, after all.
Actually, since I'm in a good mood...
He touched a finger to Ali's forehead, sending a small shock through her. Find the king's healer. Tell her this would be a good time to catch a ship for Karthak. Then he vanished. The magic he had placed on Ali told her where to find the healer on duty. The woman slept in a nearby chamber. Ali tried to grab her by the shoulder and shake her, but her hand passed through the healer's flesh.
Excuse me, she said.
The healer twitched.
Excuse me,
Ali said loudly into the healer's ear. The woman sat up with a yelp, passing through Ali. The healer glanced around.
Right here, Ali told her. Don't I glow or something?
The healer gasped.
I meant no offense, goddess.
I'm not a goddess, Ali interrupted. The gods hated it when someone who wasn't a god took the title.
I'm a messenger. King Hazarin just died. I think it was at that thing where blood vessels in the brain explode?
Apoplexy, muttered the healer, scrambling out of bed.
If I warned him once...
He's beyond warning now, Ali informed her. Perhaps this would be a good time to leave the country, before they find him.
I must warn his servants, protested the healer, going to her door. We'll all be questioned to ensure he wasn't poisoned.
His servants are warned, Ali said flatly. The healer turned and stared at her. They are leaving right now, and they didn't think to tell you. Grab your essentials and run. As the woman scrambled to pack, Ali returned to the dead man's bedroom. Kiprioth was still absent, but Hazarin's ghost sat by his former body, smiling. She could tell it was the king. He looked as if someone had painted his complete portrait on sheer cloth, except that no painter would have done a picture of Hazarin in his nightgown. "You're very cheerful for a man who's dead," Ali remarked. The ghost looked at her.
"But I'm well out of it," he explained. "All the plotting. Never knowing who's a friend and who isn't. Wondering if the food I eat is poisoned or if someone's buying grim spells to use against me. It's done. Are you the Black God?
No, Ali replied. I'm immortal. The God I...
She hesitated, not wanting to say it, but she had to give some explanation. The God I serve brought me here to see what happens. Hazarin shook his head.
It's a bad business, meddling with gods, he told Ali wisely.
I know, Ali said ruefully. If it helps, you died a natural death. That's what my god said, anyway.
I would have died of something, Hazarin replied. Really, I suppose I signed my death warrant the day I made Donivan my heir, with my sister Imogene and her husband as regents should I die before Donivan came of age. My spies told me this afternoon that Imogene's looking for death spells. This was a much better way to go. And probably everyone will think she had me killed anyway.
He grinned at the thought.
You don't sound upset, Ali remarked.
If my half-sister looked to have me killed, I'd be very upset.
Not at all, Hazarin replied. We weren't raised to like one another. My father thought if we did, we'd band together and get rid of him.
It doesn't sound like a happy way to live, Ali murmured.
Now you know why I'm glad to be out of it,
Hazarin told her. It's... Abruptly he stood and bowed at the door. Ali glanced at it over her shoulder and turned. A tall shape, robed and hooded, made all of shadows, was standing there.
I am ready to follow you, great one,
Hazarin told the shadow that was the black god.
This girl says she's mortal.
Though Ali couldn't really see much of the god's form in the dark room, she was convinced he looked her way. She didn't want to die with so much left unfinished.
This god could take her now if he wished to do so.
Trembling, Ali knelt. She felt a warm, comforting pressure on her shoulder as if someone had squeezed it. When she looked up, Hazarin's ghost and the god were gone, leaving behind the shell of Hazarin's body. Time passed. Kiprioth finally returned at dawn with a glowing chess set. He and Ali played until a guard,
concerned by the lack of activity in the royal bedchamber, cautiously opened the door. He cried the alarm. As Kiprioth and Ali watched, people came and went. Other guards were called to search for the missing servants and healer. At last, another healer arrived, a blonde, cross-looking man. He was rumpled, as if they had dragged him from bed to see to the dead king. He was just finishing his examination when the icy princess Imogene and her husband Rubinion arrived. Like the healer, they looked as if they had rushed to pull on their elegant clothes.
"Well?" demanded Imogene sharply, her blonde head high. "Was it poison?"
"It was the poison of rich gravies, fatty meats, and too much cursed coconut, as he was warned time after time, your highness," retorted the healer. "He died of apoplexy. Don't think you can torture another answer out of me, if you please. Not only am I the head of the guild, but he was not my charge. The healer who had him in care is gone. Fled, I should imagine."
Imogene glanced at the captain of the guards.
"The servants fled as well?"
The captain bowed.
"Find them and the healer," Imogene ordered in a crisp, elegant voice. "Search wherever you must." She looked at her husband. "My dear?"
"All things seem plain enough," Rubinion spoke firmly in measured, deliberate tones.
Ali shook her head in pity for Hazarin. Except for Donovan, these people were his only family, and they obviously didn't sorrow over his senseless death.
"We must ensure that the servants do not gossip," Rubinion continued, "until we can make certain that the change of rulership is complete. Donovan must be crowned as soon as possible. We need the Mithrin High Priest. He can do it quickly now, and we can stage a ceremony with all manner of pomp later."
"Certainly your highnesses can and must crown the new king before all else," said the healer, drawing a sheet over Hazarin's face. "But it is well past dawn. There has been too much coming and going here. By noon the whole city will know the king is dead."
He flung the terrace curtains wide and yelped, staggering back, eyes wide with terror.
"Who needs servants to bugle the news?" he cried, pointing.
Imogene and Rubinion moved forward to see what had frightened the man. Storm wings perched on the terrace rail, males and females alike, their bare human chests streaked with filth and caked with dark fluids, their steel wings and claws gleaming in the early morning sun. They grinned broadly, steel teeth glinting, and spread their wings, sending darts of reflected sunlight and an unspeakable smell into the room.
"Got something for us?" one of them asked. "Dead kings always mean trouble, fighting in the streets with plenty of hate and dead bodies. A meal for us."
"Not today," Rubinion said firmly. "Order will be preserved."
He yanked the drapes shut.
"You've trouble at your backs, mortal, and you're too full of yourself to notice," shrieked a female, her voice cutting through the heavy brocade drapes. "If I were you, I'd watch for the trickster's choice."
Ali looked at Kiprioth. "Do they mean me, or just the changes you're setting in motion?"
"They're storm wings," replied Kiprioth evenly. "They're just stirring things up."
Ali raised an eyebrow. "Somehow I don't believe you." Kiprioth shrugged.
"And that hurts me," he said in a blithe tone. "You have no idea how much that hurts me."
Time passed. The Mithrin High Priest and his acolytes hurried to the palace. There, in the throne room, Ali and Kiprioth looked on as the 3-year-old Donovan was prompted through a brief coronation. Ali felt bad for the little boy, who was just Elzrin's age. Donovan looked thoroughly terrified. He obeyed Imogene's orders, acting his part like a trained pony, in front of as many nobles and guild leaders as his regents could find. At last he sat perched on the immense teak throne that dwarfed him, a small, pearl-bedecked crown on his dark curls. On his right, his half-sister and regent Imogene held Donovan's diamond-crowned scepter. On his left, his co-regent, Rubinion, held a pillow with the bared sword of the king's justice on it. Bro now stood in the third rank of the nobles before the dais. He was unhappy, the look in his eyes murderous as he stared first at Imogene, then his brother. This was not the laughing, charming man who had spent so many days with the Balitongs. Looking at him now, Ali saw him as a volcano on the edge of explosion. Imogene and Rubinion saw it too. Their eyes continually flicked to Bronow throughout the proceedings. Once the last hymns were sung, Imma Jane stepped forward.
"We have a new king to ensure our safety as we take our beloved former king to his resting place," she proclaimed, her voice ringing through the stone hall. "Now must his majesty and his subjects give way to the condition of mourning, in honor of our beloved Hazarin and to cleanse our souls of sorrow."
Imogene beckoned the Black God's high priest forward through the first rank of notables. It would be his duty to see to Hazarin's burial. As he stood before the dais and proclaimed the order of the funeral rites, Ali turned to Kiprioth.
"It just occurred to me, if it's afternoon here, it's afternoon in Lamban. I have to get back before they bury me."
"They won't," Kiprioth said blithely. "Ochabu won't let them. Just enjoy the performance. How many royal funerals have you been to?"
"Why keep me dawdling?" inquired Ali at her most patient. "The Balitongs should know they have a new king, again."
"There are a few more things you should see," Kiprioth replied. "We'll just wait."
"I don't want to wait," Ali said firmly. "I need to get back. If something happens to any of the Balitong children while I'm kept here, our wager is finished. You can't say I lost if something happens to them when you have me a whole country away."
"Nothing will happen. The wager stands," Kiprioth told her. "I'm bored," she informed him. "I bore easily. I do not wish to loll about here while everyone talks and eats and does whatever other silly things these Luaran pests do for fun." "There, at least, I can help you," Kiprioth said. He raised a glowing arm and wrote a sign in the air. Shadows wrapped around her. She drifted for some time. At one point, she thought she was waking up inside her own body. She heard Ochabu say firmly,
"I can do nothing here."
"No more should you." Ali struggled to open her eyes. That was Nawat's voice. What was he doing in Inti, where she had gone to sleep? He had stayed at Tener that day.
"The god has her fast," the crow man continued. "He will give her up when he is done with her." Into Ali's ear he whispered, "If he does not give you back, my flock and our kinfolk will make him suffer." Ali struggled to reassure him, and to say his breath didn't smell of bugs in the least. In the end, the darkness in which she floated pulled her back into its depths. Finally, her awareness returned. Now she was standing in a luxurious child's room. Expensive gilded and painted toys lay on the floor. A pair of hounds, barely out of puppyhood, wrestled for control of a silk table runner. Donivan, clad all in black velvet, giggled and clapped his hands as he watched. Half-eaten marzipan fruits, candied violets, and raisins lay scattered on the rug around the boy. Ali didn't like that. From her own experience with Elzrin and Patran, she knew it was bad to give a child so many sweets. Didn't the little king have a nursemaid, someone to look after him properly? Ali thought very little of those who dressed a little boy in expensive velvets, then left him to play on the floor. She looked around for the god, but Kiprioth was nowhere in view. Wood creaked. A tapestry bulged. Someone pushed it aside to enter the room. Bronow. He was holding a wooden marionette in one hand.
"Uncle Bronow!" cried Donivan, running to him. "How did you come in? Was it magic?"
"No, just a secret door," Bronow replied, catching the boy king up in one arm. "It's our secret now." He jiggled the marionette invitingly for the child. "I told you I would bring you a present. I wanted it to be a surprise, just between us. Is your majesty pleased?"
"I'm not a majesty," replied the king, pouting.
For a moment, he looked much like his dead half-brother.
"Hazarin's a majesty. I'm a highness. I keep telling them, and they keep doing it wrong."
Bronow chuckled that rich, seductive sound he had so often lavished on Sarai. "Don't you see? Hazarin had to go away. Before he left, he made you a majesty," he explained. He looked around nervously. Ali didn't like Bronow's manner. His charming mask often slipped to reveal tension-bright eyes and tight jaw muscles. He was up to no good.
"Where's your cloak, Donivan?" he asked.
The boy pointed to a clothes press.
"But it's summer. I don't need a cloak in summer."
We're going sailing, Bronow told him, offering the child